Hi, and welcome to In the News on Chris. I'm Steve Sacco. Today I'll be reading from Time Magazine, the February 26, 2024 edition of Time Magazine. And this week we're going to start with The War Lab by Vera Bergengruen, how tech companies join forces with Zelensky's government to turn Ukraine's battlefields into a testing ground for military AI. Early on the morning of June 1st, 2022, Alex Karp, the CEO of the data analytics firm Palantir Technologies, crossed the border between Poland and Ukraine on foot, with five colleagues in tow. A pair of beaten-up Toyota Land Cruisers awaited on the other side. Chauffeured by armed guards, they sped down empty highways towards Kyiv, past bombed-out buildings, bridges damaged by artillery, and the remnants of burned trucks. They arrived in the capital before the wartime curfew. The next day, Karp was escorted into the fortified bunker of the presidential palace, becoming the first leader of a major Western company to meet with Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky since Russia's invasion 3 months earlier. Over a round of espressos, Karp told Zelensky that he was ready to open an office in Kyiv and deploy Palantir's data and artificial intelligence software to support Ukraine's defense. Karp believed that they could team up in ways that would allow David to beat a modern-day Goliath. In the stratosphere of top tech CEOs, Karp is an unusual figure. At 56, he's a lanky Tai Chi aficionado with a cloud of wiry gray curls that gives him the air of an eccentric scientist. He has a PhD in philosophy from a German university, where he studied under the famous social theorist Jürgen Habermas, and a law degree from Stanford, where he became friends with the controversial venture capitalist and Palantir co-founder Peter Thiel. After Palantir became tech's most secretive unicorn, Karp moved the company to Denver to escape Silicon Valley's monoculture, though he was typically working out of a barn in New Hampshire when he was not traveling. The Ukrainians weren't sure what to think of a man making grandiose promises across the ornate wooden table, but they were familiar with the company's reputation, recalls Mykhailo Fedorov, Ukraine's Minister of Digital Transformation, who was in that first meeting. Named after the mystical Seeing Stones in The Lord of the Rings, Palantir sells the same aura of omniscience. Seeded in part by the investment from the CIA's venture capital arm, it built its businesses providing data analytics software to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, the FBI, the Department of Defense, and a host of foreign intelligence agencies. They are the AI arms dealer of the 21st century, says Jacob Hellberg, a national security expert who serves as an outside policy advisor to Karp. In the Ukraine, Karp tells me, he saw the opportunity to fulfill Palantir's mission to defend the West and to scare the hell out of our enemies. Ukraine saw an opportunity as well. At first, it was driven by desperation, according to Fedorov, who's 33 years old. With the Russians threatening to topple Zelensky's democratically elected government and occupy the country, Kyiv needed all the help it could get. But soon, government officials realized that they had a chance to develop the country's own tech sector. European capitals to Silicon Valley, Fedorov and his deputies began marketing the battlefields of Ukraine as laboratories for the latest military technologies. Our big mission is to make Ukraine the world's tech R&D lab, says Fedorov. The progress has been striking. In a year and a half since Karp's initial meeting with Zelensky, Palantir has embedded itself into the day-to-day work of a wartime foreign government in an unprecedented way. More than half a dozen Ukrainian agencies, including the Ministries of Defense, Economy, and Education, are using the company's products. Palantir software, which uses AI to analyze satellite imagery, open-source data, drone footage, and reports from the ground to present commanders with military operations, is responsible for the most of its targeting in the Ukraine, and that's according to Karp. Ukrainian officials told me that they're using the company's data analytics for projects that go far beyond battlefield intelligence, including collecting evidence of war crimes, clearing landmines, resettling displaced refugees, and rooting out corruption. Palantir was so keen to showcase its capabilities that it provided them to Ukraine free of charge. It is far from the only tech company assisting the Ukrainian war effort. Giants like Microsoft, Amazon, Google, and Starlink have worked to protect Ukraine from Russian cyber attacks, migrate critical government data to the cloud, and keep the country connected, committing hundreds of millions of dollars to the nation's defense. The controversial U.S. facial recognition company Clearview AI has provided its tools to more than 1,500 Ukrainian officials, who have used it to identify more than 230,000 Russians on their soil, as well as Ukrainian collaborators. Smaller American and European companies, many focused on autonomous drones, have set up shop in Kyiv as well, leading young Ukrainians to dub some of the city's crowded co-working spaces as MilTech Valley. War has always driven innovation, from the crossbow to the internet, and in the modern era, private industry has made key contributions to breakthroughs like the atom bomb. But the collaboration between foreign tech companies and the Ukrainian armed forces, who say they have a software engineer deployed with each battalion, is driving a new kind of experimentation in military AI. The result is an acceleration of the most significant fundamental change in the character of war ever recorded in history. And that's according to General Mark Milley, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, to reporters in Washington last year. It can be hard to see that from afar. By all accounts, the war in the Ukraine has settled into a stalemate, with both sides hammering away with 20th century weapons like artillery and tanks. Some view the claims of the high-tech breakthroughs with skepticism, arguing that the grinding war of attrition is little affected by the deployment of AI tools. But Ukraine and its private sector allies say they're playing the longer game, creating a war lab for the future. Ukraine is the best test ground for all the newest tech, says Fedorov, because here you could test them in real-life condition. According to CARP, there are things that we can do on the battlefield that we could not do in a domestic context. If the future of warfare is being beta tested on the ground in the Ukraine, the results will have global ramifications. In conflicts waged with software and AI, where more military decisions are likely to be handed off to algorithms, the tech companies stand to wield outsized power as independent actors. The ones willing to move fast and flout legal, ethical, or regulatory norms could make the biggest breakthroughs. National security officials and experts warn that these new tools risk falling into the hands of adversaries. The prospects for proliferation are crazy, says Rita Konev of Georgetown's Center for Security and Emerging Technology. Most companies operating in the Ukraine right now say they align with U.S. national security goals. But what happens when they don't? What happens the day after? In the months since CARP's Cloak and Dagger first meeting with Zelensky, Palantir brass have fallen into a similar routine on their frequent trips to the Ukraine. In October, I met a London-based Palantir employee at the airport in Poland. We were picked up in two armored cars, handed emergency medical kits, just in case, and driven to the border with the Ukraine. Gone was what one executive described to me as the Kalashnikov between the knees vibe. We zipped through the border checkpoint where young Ukrainian recruits dozed in the light rain. After dozens of these journeys, Palantir employees have their favorite gas station snacks on the long road to Kyiv. Their favorite drivers, a hulking former soldier for the Polish Special Forces who goes by Horse, he got us there with terrifying speed, and their favorite specialty coffee shops around the capital. These days, the lobbies of Kyiv's five-star hotels are full of security details, trying to inconspicuously sip beers while waiting for foreign defense, tech, and government executives. Much of Palantir's work there is conducted in stylish co-working spaces by a team of fewer than a dozen local employees who work directly with the Ukrainian officials. When I visited one such office in October, three men with close-cropped hair and cargo pants stood out against a trendy crowd of 20-somethings before they disappeared to meet with Palantir employees in a room booked under a fake name. It often feels like a tech startup vibe. Let's see what we can do with two old cameras and a drone flying around, says Vic, an engineer who left their job at the U.S. tech giant to work for Palantir in Kyiv after the invasion, and then asked to be identified by a pseudonym for security reasons. Except that we're in the middle of a war. With a few clicks, a Ukrainian Palantir engineer showed me how they could mine a dizzying array of battlefield data until recently would have taken hundreds of humans to analyze. Palantir's software processes the raw intelligence from sources including drones, satellites, and Ukrainians on the ground, as well as radar that can see through clouds and thermal images that can detect the troop movements and artillery fire. AI-enabled models can then present military officials with the most effective options to target, and also enemy positions. The models learn and improve with each strike, according to Palantir. When the company first started working with the Ukrainian government in the summer of 2022, it was just a question of pure survival, says Louis Mosley, Palantir's executive vice president for the UK and for Europe. Palantir hired Ukrainian engineers who could adapt its software for the war effort. Government officials were trained to use a Palantir tool called Meta Constellation, which uses commercial data, including satellite imagery, to give a near real-time picture of a given battle space. Palantir's software integrates that information with commercial and classified government data, including from allies, which allows military officials to communicate enemy positions to commanders on the ground or to decide to strike a target. This is part of what CARP calls a digital kill chain. Although recent earnings data from the company indicates that partner countries have chipped in tens of millions of dollars to offset Palantir's investment, Ukraine has not paid Palantir for its tools and services. Its motivation in Ukraine has little to do with short-term profit. In recent years, Palantir has sought to shed its reputation as a shadowy data mining spy contractor as it expands its list of commercial clients. Its tools have played a role in uncovering the financial fraud carried out by Bernie Madoff, rooting out Chinese spyware installed on the Dalai Lama's computer, and allegedly aiding in the hunt for Osama bin Laden, a long-standing rumor the company has been careful not to dispute. More recently, it has highlighted its work with the UN World Food Program and the use of its software to track COVID-19 vaccine production and distribution. CARP has long dismissed widespread criticism that Palantir's tools enable intrusive government surveillance. Amnesty International has accused the company of seeking to deflect and minimize its responsibility to protect human rights, and said Palantir's tools have allowed government agencies to track and identify the migrants and asylum seekers to carry out arrests and workplace raids. The CEO says he sees a moral imperative to supply the Western governments with the best emerging technology, calling for more intimate collaboration between the state and the technology sector. That, he believes, will allow the West to maintain its edge over global adversaries. In the Ukraine, Palantir has found an opportunity to put this mission into practice while burnishing its reputation. People often have preconceived notions about Palantir, but our products work, says Vice President Josh Harris. When it's existential and when it needs to work, you take off the blinders, you take out all the politics. And in Ukraine's leaders, the company found a group of young, tech-savvy officials who could help them with more than just PR. Now let's head over to the brief. Let's start with Opener, not a quiet little town. The increased din of a Bitcoin mine is overlooked in rural America, and it's by Andrew R. Chow. Every night, the nurse anesthetist, Cheryl Shaden, lies awake in her home in Granbury, Texas, listening to a nonstop roar. It's like sitting on the runway of an airport where jets are taking off one after another, she says. You can't speak to somebody 5 feet away and have them hear you at all. The noise comes from a nearby Bitcoin mining operation, which set up shop at a power plant in Granbury last year. Since then, residents in the surrounding area have complained to public officials about an incessant din that keeps them awake, gives them migraines, and apparently has scared off wildlife. My citizens are suffering, says Hood County Constable John Shirley. Rural America has not shared much in the wealth of the tech boom or in areas without broadband, even much of the tech. But the impacts of Bitcoin mining, an energy-intensive process that powers and protects cryptocurrency, are distinctly negative for the residents. There's noise, carbon pollution, and higher utility bills. Some 34 large-scale Bitcoin mines operate across the United States, and that's according to the New York Times. And despite high-profile crypto collapses in 2022, the mining companies last year expanded operations to cash in on a rebound. One study said global energy consumption for the mining has doubled. Bitcoin is so energy-intensive because it relies on a process known as proof of work. Rather than being overseen by a single authority like a central bank, Bitcoin disperses the responsibility of the network's integrity to voluntary miners across the globe, who prevent tampering through a complex cryptographic process that consumes a vast amount of energy. Texas has become a global industry leader because the miners can access the cheap energy and land there and then benefit from friendly tax laws and regulation. Bitcoin miners consume about 2,100 megawatts of the state's power supplies, an amount that can power hundreds of thousands of homes. Companies like Riot Platforms and Marathon Digital Holdings have recently expanded in the state. Other states have pushed back. In 2022, New York imposed a moratorium on Bitcoin mining over the environmental concerns. Bitcoin mining plants like data centers run massive cooling fans to keep their computers from overheating. The rumble from the Granbury plant reached Shannon Wolf in her home 8 miles away. She thought it was a nearby train. "It has awoken me from a dead sleep before," she says. Other residents of the town, which stands on the Brazos River, an hour southwest of Fort Worth, took their complaints to social media. "This sound has been driving me to the point of insanity. I have continuous migraines. I can barely get out of my head. There's vomiting, nosebleeds, painful knots on my scalp," wrote one commenter. "All the birds have left. Only the buzzards remain," wrote another. Local officials brought their concerns to the site's operator, U.S. Bitcoin Corporation. Over the summer, the company constructed a 24-foot sound barrier wall on one end of the property at a cost of between $1 million and $2 million. But while the wall reduced the sound in some areas, it amplified it in others. "To be honest, the complaints have gotten louder for us since the migration efforts," says Constable Shirley. Texas state law stipulates that a noise is considered unreasonable if it exceeds 85 decibels. For comparison, vacuum cleaners often run at about 75 decibels, though a cardiologist told Time magazine in 2008 that chronic exposure to anything over 60 decibels had the potential to do harm to the cardiovascular system. Shaden took her own readings at her house near the Bitcoin mining facility that reached 103 decibels. But the maximum penalty for breaking that Texas law is a $500 fine, says Shirley, adding the state law is inadequate. He says that he's been talking to the county attorney's office about options for recourse. "If we have a repeated violation problem, he'll be looking into potential injunctive relief," he says. The community's ire boiled over at a packed town hall on January 29th. One of the attendees says she has been forced to put her chihuahua on seizure medication. Others said their windows rattled from the vibrations and the noise that it made their homes unsellable. "How does Hood County benefit from having such a ridiculous thing?" asked one woman. After the town hall, the site's owner, Marathon Digital Holdings, announced that it planned to take over full day-to-day operations of the Granbury Mine. "Our team will now have more influence over the site and can hopefully have a more positive impact for the community." That was according to a spokesman in an email to Time magazine. U.S. Bitcoin Corporation did not respond to a request for comment. Eric Cajola, a senior climate research specialist for Greenpeace USA, says he's monitored complaints from residents near new Bitcoin mining centers in Iowa, Indiana, Nebraska, and upstate New York. Bitcoin mining is essentially a lifeline for fossil fuels, he says. It's ultimately creating a new industrial-scale demand for energy at a time where we need to be reducing our energy use. Our next story from The Brief is in the bulletin. Unhappy farmers unsettle Europe. Tens of thousands of farmers have taken to the streets across Europe in recent weeks to protest the combined effort of poor economic conditions created by falling incomes, higher costs, ongoing disruption from the war in Ukraine, and competition from cheap imports. Their discontent is further fueled by the European Union's recent announcement of more stringent environmental policies that's affecting agriculture, which they say will make things worse. On February 1st, farmers from Germany, France, Belgium, Italy, and Greece descended on Brussels, where they blocked the roads. They lit fires and threw eggs at the European Parliament to demand that European Union leaders do more to help. First, we have roots of the problem. The European Union's proposed green policies are intended to curb the farming sector's greenhouse gas emissions, which currently accounts for 11% of Europe's total emissions. And that's by revamping the existing Common Agricultural Policy, a yearly subsidy system worth nearly $60 billion. The new policies, part of the European Green Deal, which aims to make the bloc climate neutral by the year 2050, asks that farmers devote at least 4% of arable land to non-productive features, carry out crop rotations, and reduce fertilizer use by at least 20%. Second, we have greening the fields. Many farmers' anger is fueled by perceived contradiction, and that's according to 44-year-old Morgan Adi, a French farmer from the region of Brittany. On the one hand, we are asked to farm more sustainably. On the other, we're asked to keep producing as cheaply as possible, which puts us in an impossible situation, says Adi, who represents a French farming union. Further grievances vary from country to country. In Germany, for example, farmers are angry about a proposed phasing out of tax breaks on agricultural diesel. In the Netherlands, there's a revolt against the requirement to reduce nitrogen emissions. But continent-wide, farmers share concerns that the measures will make the European agricultural sector less competitive against imports. And lastly, we have planting change. Some leaders want the rules to be loosened in response to the protests. French President Emmanuel Macron has asked the European Union to profoundly change its rules in order to guarantee fair prices paid to the farmers by food giants and supermarkets. And the European Commission is proposing more relaxed green requirements while still allowing agricultural subsidies. Several governments have announced their own aid packages. Everywhere in Europe, the same question arises, says France Prime Minister Gabriel Attal, while announcing the $160 million for French farmers in need. How do we continue to produce more but better? How can we continue to tackle climate change? How can we avoid unfair competition from foreign countries? He asks. I think we have time for one more. Good question. Where do Americans stand on consensual non-monogamy? And it's by Katie Lang. Nearly one-third of singles in America have had a consensually non-monogamous relationship, but many singles are still committed to the concept of traditional sexual monogamy. That's the word from the survey informing the 2024 Match Singles in the America report. But it's also all over popular culture. In mainstream television shows, books, and media reports, where consensual non-monogamy is having a moment. Anthropologist Helen Fisher, Match's chief science advisor, calls it an exciting development in the consensual non-monogamy, but it's hardly new. There's every reason to think that having sex outside of the pair bond has quite common for millions of years, Fisher told Time magazine. What's actually extraordinary is that we bother to pair up at all, and indeed we do. According to the report, which was released in January and marked the first time Match asked about non-monogamy, while 31% of singles in America have explored the consensual non-monogamy, also known as ethical non-monogamy, 49% of singles say that traditional sexual monogamy is still their ideal sexual relationship. For a third of singles who reported trying it, consensual non-monogamy covers a range. Polyamory, where relationship partners agree that each may have a romantic relationship with other people, and then there's open relationships, a committed primary relationship that openly allows for romantic and/or sexual activities with others. Then there's swinging, expanding an exclusive romantic relationship to seek out other sexual partners together, and being monogamish, a committed relationship that allows for sexual variety with others, either together or individually. Fisher says that monogamy is carryover from early farming cultures when couples were dependent on each other to farm, making pair bonding necessary, especially for the women who were forced to be dependent on men who were the property owners. She theorizes that the current interest is consensual non-monogamy that can be traced back to the more of the hunting-gathering societies, where women could express their sexuality because, as gatherers, they were as visible as male partners in contributing to the economy. Fisher points to the contemporary rise of women in the job market, as well as their increased education and ability to keep and inherit their own money, as key advances that have aided in more sexual self-expression. I do think that the rise of consensual non-monogamy is part of a much larger cultural sweep, back to life as it was a million years ago, where women and men could express their sexuality without having their heads chopped off, as was the case in the farming cultures, she says. According to Fisher, this shift has led to singles of today being more creative and willing to think out of conventions when it comes to their needs, desires, and relationships, and she says that will have a positive outcome. What's interesting about the consensual non-monogamy is not the non-monogamy, she says. It's the fact that it's consensual and that it's being normalized. I can only think that it's a huge societal blooming of self-expression. Many of the singles who engaged in consensual non-monogamy did feel that the experience positively impacted their dating life. 38% said their non-monogamous experiences have made them better understand what they do and don't want and need in a relationship, while 29% say they've become more emotionally mature. It's helped improve their sex lives as well. 30% of single people reported becoming more open sexually, and 27% say they were able to have more frequent sex. What I think is beautiful is this year's data showing that consensual non-monogamy can have a real positive impact for future relationships, says Fisher. It is, in fact, enhancing them. Well, that's all the time we have for today. I've been reading from Time Magazine, the February 26, 2024 edition of Time Magazine. I'm Steve Sacco. So long until next time.